This committee to order at 1:03 p.m. Today is Wednesday, April 26th. Present at this time, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, our Vice Chair, Representative Dean Westlake, Co-Chair, Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. So please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our ever-lovely Miss Tillinghast, and Kyle Schramm is our LIO moderator. Thank you to both of you for your help this afternoon. Before we get started, if we could please ask individuals to silence your cell phones, that would be helpful, although I think people enjoy the donuts too, so that's up to you. We have two bills that are going to come before the committee today, House Bill 197, Community Seed Libraries, and House Bill 107, Fish Enhancement Permits. We do have some time restrictions with some individuals related to House Bill 107, so we're going to take that measure up first. But I don't expect that will take too long, and then we'll go to House Bill 197. I did want to just double check, because I know members are losing staff and things like that, that everyone has the documents that you need for these bills. If not, Thatcher could probably grab them from outside. So please let our office know if that becomes an issue in the coming days, and we can try to be helpful and get documents out to offices if that helps. Okay, so it looks like we have what we need in front of us. So then that will bring House Bill 107 back before us. I don't know if the bill sponsor or staff want to come to the table.
For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Tallarico, and we do have amendments. I don't know if you want me to, if we're going to talk about those first, or if you guys have any questions for me, I'm ready.
Okay, let's start with that, Mr. Verhagen. Thank you. We're working off of version R at this time, which is the committee substitute that came out of the Fisheries Committee, and then Representative Tallarico's office have submitted two amendments for consideration. Were there any questions before we looked at the amendments? Okay.
Madam Chair, just if any of the members are interested, we did run out of time last time, and Brian Ashton with TCC is here in the room, and so if he can also take questions as well about the process.
Excellent. Thank you. Did anyone have questions for Mr. Ashton? Is that right, Ashton? Okay. Seeing no questions, then we have the version R before us, and we have these couple of amendments. I would imagine the bill sponsor would like to move these amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and if I can get the amendments from staff.
Details. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move amendment number one, which would be identified as 30-LS0396/R.1.
Okay. I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you'd allow me to, I'll just read the amendment, and sure, it'll be much more self-explanatory. On page 4, line 16, we would delete A and insert: the commissioner may modify, suspend, or revoke a permit issued under this section for good cause. If a permittee violates this section, a regulation adopted under this section, or a condition of a permit issued under this section, the commissioner may, after giving a permittee notice and an opportunity to be heard, suspend or revoke a permit issued under this section. And J would read subject to I of this section A, and we would re-letter the rest of the bill accordingly.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would request copies of the amendments, as I don't seem to have them in my packet.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease. Joined us. Representative Parrish, did you have a question now that you have the amendment in front of you?
No.
Okay. Are there any other questions or points of discussion on this amendment? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know the issue was brought up, and several people have talked to me about, well, you know, everything doesn't always work according to plan sometimes. Mm-hmm. And something goes amiss or goes sideways or something's misunderstood. What do we actually do, you know, to correct that? And so this amendment was brought forward to address that particular issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Please let the record reflect that Representative Drummond has joined us. And we do have Forrest Bowers with Department of Fish and Game. Would you please come up and join us and just address the issue that Representative Tallarico raised, you know, what would happen in the circumstance of a bad actor and how this amendment might address that?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Forrest Bowers, Deputy Director, Division of Commercial Fisheries. So the amendment that you're discussing adds provisions to HB 107 that would allow for revocation or amendment of a permit. And those provisions are consistent with language that we have in our other permitting regulations and statutes. And, you know, we would try to work with the permittee first if any deficiencies were identified. I mean, our intent would be to try to get those deficiencies corrected and get, you know, the course corrected rather than immediately just revoke a permit. But, you know, as Representative Tallarico mentioned, you know, things sometimes don't always go as planned. And, you know, perhaps a person, you know, gets a permit, their plans change, they no longer are interested in pursuing the project, or it doesn't work out the way they thought it would, you know, they could apply for an amendment. Or likewise, if someone just couldn't follow through on the permit terms or was violating the permit terms, then we would have the ability to revoke that permit.
And if I could just ask, in those other circumstances, it is always the power of the commissioner to revoke the permit? Is that always the decision maker in the case of other permits?
That's correct, Madam Co-Chair. You know, often that authority is delegated to other staff in the department, but ultimately that is the commissioner's authority.
Okay. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I might take this opportunity as an engineer in the crowd asking a question of somebody who actually might have some knowledge in this area. We've had some testimony and some discussion about now a hatchery. This proposal, basically, as I understand it, you know, once the salmon fry progress to a point where they're maybe just hatched and then released, so they're never fed or anything. But I've gotten some concerns voiced in testimony about spreading maladaptive traits. I've got concerns voiced about the hatchery actually adversely influencing the normal evolutionary mm-hmm. practice of salmon spawning in a stream. I don't get it, because it seems like this proposal sidetracks all of that, because you're not raising any salmon in a hatchery at all. In fact, you're basically fertilizing the eggs, keeping those salmon in a manner, but then immediately discharging them into those their source waters, if you will. Am I missing something, I don't see how that could adversely impact a natural run, if you will, of salmon.
And Mr. Bowers, I just want to interrupt briefly, just because we have the amendment in front of us, mm-hmm. And so I don't know if that's what's prompting you, but I don't want us to get too sidetracked off of the mm-hmm. amendment before, because we will absolutely have time for discussion. So if you want to answer that now, but then. Just let's not forget we have the amendment in front of us.
Sure thing, Madam Chair, Representative Birch. That's a good question, and that's a concern. Concern about loss of genetic diversity or loss of fitness is a concern that we hear, associated with almost any enhancement project. And you know, this bill, you know, would allow for small scale fishery enhancement or rehabilitation. As you mentioned, the fry wouldn't be fed or would simply be eyed eggs placed back into the gravel. The one concern, that we've heard is that, in the wild, fish select mates or any animals select mates naturally using you know, certain adaptive characteristics that they have, that they've evolved through natural selection. And so when we are in a sort of a hatchery setting or an enhancement setting, we're doing the mate selection for the fish. And so there could be some loss of fitness through that process, because, you know, we don't know that all the drivers of that, of mate selection. And so that is a valid concern, but there's mitigation that can be done on that by ensuring that you have a large population, that, you know, you have enough fish that you're going to be spawning in your rehabilitation project, so that you don't run into a genetic diversity bottleneck. So that there are ways to mitigate that, but that's a concern that we hear.
Yeah. And it sounds like this amendment basically preserves to the Fish and Game basically the ability to kind of throttle that or manage that, if you will, again, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch. Yeah, the bill does have that language that would allow us to provide those stipulations in the permit.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Westlake.
Yes, and through the chair. Mr. Bauer, now, the section that we're deleting now, if you're familiar with that, okay. So your permit comes up for renewal every 3 years, and it goes forward. The new amendment deletes that, and excuse me, if you don't have it, I'll be glad to share it.
I have it.
Okay.
One brief at ease.
Bauer, I was so confused, like the fish out there, but wasting your time.
Thank you, Representative Westlake. Any other questions or comments on this amendment? Okay, then I will remove my objection to this amendment. Does anyone else have an objection to adopting amendment number one? Okay, amendment number one has been adopted. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number two.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for reference, this is 30-LS0396/R.2. And Madam Chair, if I could, first I want to thank Representative Josephson for having a lengthy discussion, I think, over this section and what it actually did. And I really did think I knew what it did, because of some of the there have been some reconstruction projects along riverbanks and things and everything. Well, we actually checked with Ledge Legal and talked to them about it, and our attorney said, you know what? He said, that section doesn't even need to be in the bill. He says, because it really doesn't really address anything particularly like that. It was put in there when they drafted it, kind of connecting it somehow or another to that particular area statute, which it didn't need to be connected or anything. So we had a discussion with him. Mr. Verhagen discussed it with him at length as well. And so we decided, he said, no, it really doesn't need to be in there, because the question arose. And like I say, I do want to thank Representative Josephson. He and I sat down and had a discussion about it, and he made me think, wait a minute, why is that really in there, and does it need to be in there? So that's why I brought this amendment forward. So thanks again.
Excellent. Thank you. We do have Alpheus Bullard on the phone. I imagine he was the drafter for the bill as well as the amendment. Mr. Bullard, did you have anything you want to add at this time? We're looking at amendment number two, which deletes section two of the bill. Hello? Did we unmute Mr. Bullard?
Chair Tarr, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
This is Alpheus Bullard of Ledge Legal, and unless there are questions from the committee, I have nothing to add.
Okay. Thank you. Then Mr. Bullard is online. Does anyone have questions for the sponsor, his staff, Mr. Bowers, or Mr. Bullard?
About amendment number two? No.
About amendment number two. Okay. Any conversation? And just for folks listening in, amendment number two that removes section number two I think some of the concern was the way it read could potentially be interpreted that if you were doing a construction project, instead of, you know, mitigating the impacts of that, you could otherwise participate in a rehabilitation permit, and that, you know, maybe that wasn't where we wanted to go. I don't have any other objection to this amendment, so I or do
briefities.
You have a question? Oh, briefities, okay. Of amendment number two, Representative Rauscher, did you have a question?
No, I'm fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, sure. Representative Parrish has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably, properly speaking, a question for Fish and Game. Is this the paragraph deleted unnecessary because it's already the case that this sort of project could be considered by the department in as a alternative to rehabilitation?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish. So this section two definitely has created a little bit of confusion, and you know, I want to apologize because the last time I was here, I feel like I didn't accurately characterize the intent of the section. I spoke with I attended the meeting with Representative Tallarico and Co-Chair Josephson, and then after that, I spoke with Seth Bosang in the Department of Law, who's the attorney that we work with a lot. And so section two relates to AS 1605871, which relates to fish habitat permits that it will be issued related to a construction project. And I think the reason section two was initially in here is that some of the enhancement or rehabilitation projects that would be permitted under HB 107, they might require one of those permits as well. And I mean, it's possible, it's not 100% certain that they would, but that is a possibility. And so I think that's why section two was initially in here. We would still go through the same permitting process for those permits, you know, irregardless of whether or not Section 2 remains in HB 107. It wouldn't change our process at all. Just kind of adds another bit of language in there referencing those permits, and that the commissioner would have to consider whether or not a person had one of these HB 107 permits when evaluating their fish habitat permit application, Madam Chair.
Okay. Does that answer your question? Follow-up?
Yes, actually, for this one, it does. Okay. Thank you.
So no follow-up?
No follow-up.
Okay. Any other questions about that section or comments about that? Okay. Then I will remove my objection to amendment number two. Is there any other objection to adopting amendment number two? Seeing no other objection, amendment number two has been adopted. We do have several individuals online for public testimony. What happened, if you recall, at the end of our last meeting, we were really pressed up there against the deadline and basically just very quickly wrap things up. And so we do have some folks here for public testimony, so we'll go ahead and... Sure. Okay. Yeah. So before we go to public testimony, Representative Josephson has a question for Mr. Bowers.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Mr. Bowers, just a couple questions I'm curious about. You said that you hear concerns, the department hears concerns about enhancement programs, and I'm wondering whether the concerns about this program are different in type. I don't know enough about hatcheries to know whether it's the same sort of concerns or whether these are different because, for example, other hatcheries are tied to some, generally to some quasi-governmental institution, and this isn't. Is that, that seems to be one distinction I keep reading about, but that's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the concerns are similar. You know, we hear concerns about genetic concerns, so loss of genetic diversity in wild stocks, interbreeding between hatchery-produced and naturally produced fish. That's one of the major concerns that we hear. We also hear concerns about introduction of disease or pathology concerns. There's other, you know, fishery management related issues that come up related to the large-scale PNP hatcheries, but those are sort of separate from the biology aspects. So I'd say the biological aspects, those concerns are pretty much universal. You know, we hear those on any enhancement or rehabilitation type program involving a hatchery.
A follow up?
Yeah, thank you, through the co-chair. I guess my other question, I could ask this for Department of Commerce, ledge liaison, virtually anyone, but I'm curious about your internal process, whether there's like robust debate within ADF&G, and whether you ask the hatcheries biologists their opinion, and then that bounces back up to the sort of directors in the top echelons for an internal debate, that sort of thing. I'm just curious how that works.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's a good question. We have an internal review process that involves staff from both the Division of Sport Fisheries and Division of Commercial Fisheries. The review process, I mean, it starts at the area level, so the area offices that are closest to the project in question, that it would be most familiar with those resources. Those staff review and comment on the application, comes up into the regional office, and there's additional review and comment. If there's concerns, we go back to the applicant, ask them for clarification, or we may provide stipulations on the permits to address those concerns. And then ultimately, there's a review by staff and headquarters at the director and sometimes at the commissioner's office level if it warrants that. I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And a follow-up.
Just my last question is, the department's position on this is generally neutral, or how would you characterize it? Or supportive, or what?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, we definitely don't have any objections to the bill. The bill actually has some provisions in it that are stronger in terms of the conservation measures than our current bioenhancement and research permit. You know, we do see it as a little bit duplicative of our existing permits, but you know, we definitely don't have any objections. I'd say we're a neutral, leaning towards positive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I guess before we go to public testimony, we might as well take this opportunity. So just we do have Seth Bossing, the Assistant Attorney General, online. We have Alpheus Bullard from Ledge Legal, and then Mr. Bowers, just so that they don't have to wait for public testimony. We could see if there are any additional questions for any of those folks at this time. Representative Wesley.
Thank you. And through the chair, Mr. Bowers, I'm from way up north, so we don't have the fisheries or anything. I'm kind of confused in that, you know, I've heard this genetic weakness stuff, yet you're taking indigenous fish from there. Mm-hmm. You're doing a hatchery. Everything's from there. So you release the fish, they go out there in this fish world. Mm-hmm. And they come back. Sorry. I don't understand the argument on genetic inferiority. Mm-hmm. If they're surviving along with the other fish that are in there. Can you explain that to me, please?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Westlake. So it's not necessarily a question of inferiority. It's a question of potential loss of diversity. So say you have a salmon population that's spawning in a particular body of water, and when you go in and do your enhancement project, maybe you only are selecting certain individuals, maybe based on size of the fish or maybe where they're at, they're easier to catch. And by doing that, and then when you put them into the, you know, the incubation or rearing setting, you're increasing their survival of those eggs and juveniles. So they have an advantage and might be able to outcompete the other fish just because of that advantage. And, I mean, that's the intent, and, you know, to increase survival. And so if you're selecting, maybe intentionally or not, certain individuals in the population, then you're disadvantaging other individuals.
Thank you, sir.
No follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. I'm glad you asked that, though. That's a very good question. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, do we have a fiscal note from the Division of Ag or anything?
Let's see, Representative Rusher. I believe we have fiscal notes, but I don't believe it's from Division of Ag. I think it's from Division of Fish and Game. And let's see
zero.
Here. I believe it's a zero fiscal note because at this time, and maybe Mr. Bowers could speak to that, it's, you know, you're issuing permits. It wouldn't change the type of work you're doing. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Rauscher. We have a team in place that evaluates this type of permit application already, and so you know, we don't anticipate a large number of permit applications if this bill becomes law, and so they would just be absorbed into our normal workload, and we wouldn't be hiring any new staff or you know, requesting an increment to fund this program, Madam Chair.
Any follow-up, Representative Rauscher?
I understand the comment, the answer, but I thought they usually chime in with a zero or something then.
It is a zero fiscal note. There is a zero fiscal note.
Okay.
Yes.
I didn't have it in my packet.
Oh,
I apologize.
I think it may be the page you just passed over there.
I just got the end of this.
Okay.
I haven't looked through it yet.
Okay. Let us know if it's not in there, and then we can. I think that might be the first and second page, but it's just stapled as two separate pages there.
Right there.
Thank you.
Mr. Verhagen had a comment as well.
Yeah, for the record, Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Tallarico. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, there's also in the bill a $100 application fee when you apply for a permit. And so, again, talking with Sam Raybung from the department, that $100 application fee should, if there are any extra, a little bit of workload or anything, it should take care of the costs.
Any other questions?
Oh, lots, but public testimony.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and reopen public testimony. And it looks like we have about five or six people. There are a couple names on here. I'll just mention that I believe testified at the first meeting. And so we're going to go to individuals who haven't yet testified. So we're going to start here at the Kodiak LIO with Oliver Holm, if Mr. Holm is available.
Hello, my name is Oliver Holm. I'm representing myself. I'm certainly not against salmon enhancement. I spent 30 years volunteering as a board member of a regional salmon enhancement program association. But I do have some concerns for the bill. Under Section 1, page 2, lines 14, 15, the C5, it says the species and number of fish to be taken, and if applicable, the number to be taken for a brood stock. To me, that implies that fish would be permitted to be taken that weren't for brood stock, and I guess that would concern me greatly if it went beyond the numbers for brood stock. The 500, the part in Section 1, page 2, line 31, see the under application of where the commissioner may give out a permit. It says the population of the species of fish is limited. Of course, all populations of fish is limited, so that seems kind of wide open. The 500,000 egg limit for the permits could be between 200 to over 500 adult salmon taken for eggs. This could be pretty significant to some depressed populations, so I'd hope that the department would have the liberty to disallow granting permits in places where they're too depressed. I'm concerned about the added burden to the department without money to do this. The permitting section, I believe, is losing another position in the next year here, the budget year. And the permit, the bill has pretty set tight timelines for handling the permits and issuing them, and I'm concerned that that may be difficult for the department to accomplished without reducing their ability to handle regular permitting for the regional aquaculture associations and the other nonprofits. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holm. Really good comments. Any questions for Mr. Holm? Okay. Don't see any questions for you today. But I do have one. I just want to clarify. When you were saying the $500,000 for the egg limit, you're saying that's, you know, 200 to 500 adult salmon needed to harvest for that, and that that may be too many in an area where the stock is otherwise challenged or strained.
Correct. That's the approximate round numbers, but with the average fecundity of, say, sockeye, coho, king salmon, and chump salmon, that's in the ballpark.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Holm. Really appreciate your testimony today. Next, we'll stay at the Kodiak LAO and go to Alexis Quachaca.
Quachaca. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alexis Quachaca. I'm adamantly opposed to this. You know, as Forrest said earlier, you know, this is basically duplicating what we can already do. We can look to Europe, the East Coast, and the West Coast at failed salmon policies. We have excellent resource, and we need to be concentrating on taking care of the fish that we have, returning, and figuring out how to encourage them to spawn more and be more productive without playing with Mother Nature by being God, so to speak. And I think this is the wrong way to go. I think we need to be stronger. You know, I just drove down from Fairbanks to Anchorage, and you know, I think about the degradation that's going on our streams already. You know, I see more side-by-sides and four-wheelers, you know, that aren't supposed to be crossing streams that are crossing streams, and I just don't want this to be an avenue to try to shore up species that are being impacted by more human impact. We can do a much better job of managing what we already have without tinkering with Mother Nature. It's critical that we keep the diversity and the survivability going with the fish that we have returning to those streams without, you know, introducing who knows what. And I just want to caution everybody sitting around the table that, pathways to hell are, gotten there on good intentions. So I'm a big no on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Quacha. I think I was Quachka. I was trying to get that right. Apologize if I didn't. We appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Okay. I don't see any questions for you this afternoon. So, again, thank you so much. Really appreciate your comments. Next, we are going to go to the off-net, and we have Roberta Highland.
Hello. Roberta Highland here in Homer. And I am opposed to this bill also. Alexis said it well for that, and that we need way more information to review the abundance of research at our disposal. And I know that adding fish may sound like a solution, but it frequently has far-reaching consequences. And every time you add fish somewhere, you're very possibly weakening our wild stocks, and those are what we should be concentrating on. Hatcheries, I'm very sorry to say, carry with them a lot of problems, and they have been ignored. The problems have been ignored for a long time. And when you're overtaxing a food source for all salmon, when you add 500,000 or a million or 100 million or whatever, you are messing around with Mother Nature. And humans have not done the best job. Whenever we mess around, there are consequences we can't take into consideration because you just can't outthink all the different issues. So I oppose this bill, and if nothing else, hold it, and let's get our research done, and let's make sure we're not messing around with something that in perfection works, except that when human beings are added, we have problems, and I'm just going to call it human stupidity for the things of degrading the habitat, and those are the things we need to educate on. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hyland. We really appreciate your comments. Are there any questions for the testifier? I have one. Ms. Hyland, you mentioned, and I appreciate this, it's something I hadn't thought of, and I just wonder if you have any sources to sort of read a little bit more on this, the idea of overtaxing the food source for the other salmon. So, you know, in this stream, there's a certain, you know, supply of food source for the fry as they're developing, and what you're saying is, you know, when you come in and you inflate the numbers artificially, then there'll be too much competition for that available food source. Do you have anything else to add about that, or how to, you know, if you have some examples of that happening and the problems that followed?
Yes, there's been a lot of new research. I can't touch it right now in the mess I've got here, but there's a lot of research coming out on hatcheries, and I'm very sorry to say, because I'm somebody who likes to keep doing things the way we've been doing them, but when you find out that it's wrong, you have to change. And there was a fellow on Talk of Alaska yesterday, Paul Greenberg, and he's written a book, Fish on My Plate, and Omega Question, and he is really talking about this. And I would love if people would get that program from yesterday. It was the Tuesday Talk of Alaska. And apparently there was going to be a documentary on TV maybe last night or tonight on Channel 7. I missed it. But there is a lot of information, and I'd be glad to get you some.
Please do, if you would want to send it to my office, and then we could share with committee members. That would be helpful. And very timely, I guess, that yesterday's Talk of Alaska was on a topic that talked about this. So appreciate that, Ms. Hyland. No other questions? Okay. Thank you so much. We'll look for information from you. We appreciate that. We also have next here Eric Gebbard from the Nenana School District.
Hi, for the record, my name is Eric Gebhardt. I'm the superintendent of the Nenana City School District, and the principal interest of a school district is the educational benefit, and I am calling to speak in support of HB 107. We feel that it would be of educational benefit to our students. It would encourage curriculum development that would meet educational standards in science as well as cultural standards, both of which are critical and of interest to many rural Alaskan students. We would be able to work with parties who are educated in this area to teach our students about what is proper, what is good, and how to enhance and grow the wild salmon runs and restore those that we used to have in this state. So we have interested students, we have interested teachers, we have an interested community, and so we do speak in support of HB 107.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Really appreciate it, Mr. Gebhardt. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay. We don't see any questions at this time. So, again, thank you so much for taking the time this afternoon to testify before our committee. And then next we have Mr. David Otness.
Good afternoon, Chair Tarr. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay, this is David Otness of Cordova. I'm representing myself. This is a lot on the plate to absorb after I just came in here on a totally unrelated bill, although I did testify here before. It's good to hear the concerns being expressed on this bill. However, I don't think I'm totally connecting the dots on such as my friend Oliver Holmes' testimony, and if you have a salmon run that is so stressed to the point where it's about ready to go extinct, the best thing that could be done is actually to enhance its possibilities of continuance. I just don't understand the logic there where where putting them in a predator diminished environment is going to actually have a negative effect on it. Something just isn't adding up to me there. Because and insofar as the hatchery environment, it's not a hatchery. It's not a large scale what we're used to industrial wise, such as Piswak and the Kodiak Southeast hatcheries. It's nothing like that. There's no food. There's no antibiotics. It's as natural as you can get without, you know, having them in the wild. And regarding genetic selection, the usual means of fertilizing the eggs is to use several males, if not, you know, as many as you can possibly get. But if you're already down to a point where you've got minimum access to the species that's spawning in the same creek or tributary, your choices are pretty limited. And at that point, you might end up with fewer than you would normally use under those circumstances. But if the point is to save the run and actually enhance it, I don't see the arguments here. And one more point regarding some of the testimony from Kodiak is we're not talking about urban areas that are overrun with four-wheelers. We're talking a large part about villages up north, smaller communities that don't have this kind of intense pressure. And we're talking thousands of square miles, perhaps. And so I think that argument is slightly off base. And I respect these people who are testifying. In fact, I've known of them and actually met them and communicated on many other issues. But I just don't think the points being made are valid for this. And I respect immensely the people up north who are having trouble. There are so many environmental stressors post-spawning, whether it's out on the ocean or going down the river and getting back up. They've got to run a gauntlet all of their lives, sometimes up to 7 years in king salmon. And if I may, I'd like to state how timely this is for me in all of its serendipity for the bill coming up in front of me. Out of the blue. Here in the Copper River, we've had some real issues in our commercial salmon fishery lately. Last year was a total bust for the seiners, and it was a total bust for the gillnetters all season long until we got a really strong hit of cohos late in the season, and that salvaged a lot of people's seasons. Now this year, under the management plan, we're looking at a total catch of 4,000 king salmon, period. And this river has supported a commercial fishery in the past of upwards of 60,000 king salmon being taken. And for some reason, they're not getting back. And what this does is not only, you know, puts the viability of the run in question, but it also shuts down the entire gillnet fishery if that cap is exceeded. They're already undergoing very, very limited openings. It's a very conservative form of management that is being practiced here, and people should be aware of that on a larger level, that sacrifices are being made here on the lower river end, and it begs the question of adequate enforcement upstream, because the sport fishery is likely to be shut down as a result of this too. And what I'm getting at is if there's a possibility of enhancing even our run on the Copper River, it opens up much more accessibility to all the people from Anchorage, all the people from Fairbanks, and even the fish wheelers and others who partake of the resource, if we possibly get some enhancement going on this. And this is not set in stone. A friend of mine, a longtime commercial fisherman here, and I were speaking of this yesterday just out of the blue. And I would not like to see this shut down by any means. And a trial run being given in represented at Tallarico's district sounds like a pretty good plan to me. I think we've got enough safeguards on it. Fish and Game is aware of it. I just see a lot more pluses to it than I do negatives. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate those comments. As I mentioned earlier, we did have a couple of people also online that had testified at the first meeting, and so generally we just do one opportunity for testimony. However, Mr. Ashton, you were the last person at the last meeting, and most of the members had to get up and leave at that point. So I do want to give you an opportunity if you just want to come up, and I wasn't doing a good job with timing people, so as a matter of fairness, you know, do a couple minutes as what we typically offer to everyone, so I'm not kind of upsetting the apple cart here.
Sure, thank you. My name is Brian Ashton. I'm representing myself, but TCC called me this morning, Tanana Chiefs, and asked me to represent a message from them as well, from Vice President Will Mayo. So I'll cover that first. Will Mayo just asked me to express to you folks that this tool is a necessary tool that they want to have in their tool belt for being able to help manage their fisheries resources that have been depleted and depleted for a very, very long time. They'd like to work very closely with Fish and Game to do it appropriately, as it has been done for the past 15 years and in some cases on the Copper River 43 years. So it's been done, it's worked, there have never been any major crises in genetics, it simply works. But there's no formal process in place to basically do this and say, we have a stock of concern, we'd like to do something about it and help it. And this bill basically just simply creates a very clear process for when you want to do this, to do it, make sure it's done right. Let me jump over to my own testimony, as I just wanted to clarifying some things in the testimony. The number of eggs, and I've been doing this and helping communities do this and get permits from Fish and Game through this circuitous process that exists today that's not clear. And the issue of the number of eggs is very, very tightly managed. They're looking at the number of fish in the creek. They're looking at how many fish you want to take. It goes, the process, I can tell you from experience, it goes through the sport fish, the confith, pathology, genetics, and the regional managers. And they all basically sign off in the last sheet. There's a sign-off on all those departments, and the final signature is the commissioner approving the existing permits today. So it's scrutinized very, very well. This is talking about for stocks that are at risk to such a level that they're already, the genetic integrity is at risk. Because what happens is when the stock gets so low that you basically have the brothers and sisters coming back to spawn, then you have a problem. And so what I've heard many, many times about the genetics going, oh my gosh, you're gonna choose how they mate. Well, in the lower 48, I've been in meetings where they basically have to reintroduce more fish, in this case coho in California, to a river system that were non-native, because they said that there's so few fish that if they mate, we're going to have a genetic problem. Mm-hmm. The brothers and sisters should not be mating. Mm-hmm. Genetics, basically, in one particular case on a permit in Nome about 10 years ago, said you need to take at least 80,000 eggs so that we get the genetic diversity that we need. So they are completely on board this. They understand the genetic processes, and it works. So, and if I may, my last thing I want to say is just a slight story, because I've been in the creeks and I watched this happen. And I've witnessed this, but we also have videos of this, where the fish come into a creek and they start to spawn. And just like in other wildlife situations, there are these big alpha males that basically go, I'm spawning and you're not, so stay away. And the smaller males will actually hang back from the females that are going to spawn. And depending on the species, some females will spawn 3 to 5 times. They'll make several different reds. And the big males will stay right there next to her, and it's hilarious watching, because the little guy will start coming up there, and man, that big dog just runs him down the creek, you know. But what happens is the spawning starts, and when the big male alpha starts to do his thing, he can't watch out for what's going on, and the smaller males will race in underneath him and do their thing. And as the male regains his composure, it's clear he's furious and takes off down the creek after these. And it is hilarious to watch, but it's also educational, because you basically go genetic diversity in action. And Fish and Game's policy with the hatcheries, which this is not, But even for the mega hatcheries, which I helped design a 110 million facility back in the 90s, which was the 10th largest hatchery in the world, you basically had very strict guidelines to say, regardless if you want to go just catch only the 30-pound cohos and leave the puny ones out, the policy was we need this genetic diversity even in the hatchery environment. And they have very clear policies that say you take this many males and you take this many females and you mix them together to preserve that. So we're talking about genetic policy that's been developed for many, many years that in the case of the Copper River they've been using for better than 44 decades with no measurable problems. And there's actually been environmental groups that have come in to basically do testing to find a problem, and at the end of the studies they said, nope, no problem here. The sockeye run in the Copper River is as good as it has always been. And if anybody can test the value of the Copper River reds, it's the first Copper River, it's the first reds that hit the market. They're incredibly valuable. If there was a problem, they would have been addressed in it a long time ago. So thank you for your time.
Appreciate those comments. Let's see, I thought I saw Representative Parrish and then Birch with questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ashton. For the Copper River hatchery in particular, how many eggs do you get fertilized here?
Since they started in 1973, and currently in the last at least 10 years, they've been doing 36 million eggs a year. The Copper River has got a unique situation in that when the big earthquake happened, some of the ground changed and shifted, and it basically didn't allow the fish to basically migrate in certain areas. But also they found back in the 60s and 70s that there was a huge amount of habitat for those fish, but very little spawning ground. Mm-hmm. Someone had the bright idea to say, if the habitat's there for them, but there's not enough place for them to spawn, let's assist them in that. And it's been a huge success ever since. And there's been incredible studies there that I can actually arrange to have forwarded to you so you can review those. Because each hatchery is actually scrutinized intensely. A lot of Sam Raybong, who manages the permit process and has for years, his job is basically answering these types of questions and showing people the data of how the hatcheries have to go through these review processes every several years to make sure everything is okay. And although this is not a hatchery, this will certainly fall under that as well, but it doesn't nearly come to some of the challenges and the questions people have about conventional hatcheries.
Any follow-up, Representative Parrish?
Not at this time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Birch.
I don't know about anybody else, but I'm smelling a brand new Alaska reality TV show. I just the salmon thing is fascinating. one of the things I was kind of curious about. If you have world record king salmon in Kenai or someplace else in the West Coast, can you transport those fry into another stream? Can you introduce salmon into another stream if you have the large 70-pound you hear records large salmon, how amenable are those are the salmon to being basically reintroduced into either a dead stream or one where they're extinct? Does that work, or is that very effective?
It is done today. In certain places in the lower 48, they actually have, like coho in certain river systems, where they simply go, these are simply not the indigenous coho anymore, because 80 years ago somebody had the bright idea to put coho in there and stuff. And it's really convoluted the issues and stuff. The short answer is yes, you can do it, but this bill basically doesn't give you the leeway to do that as far as transplanting, because in my opinion, we need to learn a lot more about genetics to go that far. And the bill was carefully selected and written in a way to where you don't have somebody with a wild idea to say, wow, look at those king salmon and white horse, huge amounts of omega-3s and oils and stuff, very valuable. Let's put them in this watershed over here, because that really is, in my personal opinion, that's going too far. However, because you made that point, I would like to bring up a point. The largest king salmon caught on record was caught just east or just west of Petersburg on the northeast corner of Prince of Wales Island. It was 126 pounds. 126 pounds. It was caught in a fish trap in, I believe, 1946. The management of the day assumed that it was one of the last of the June hogs. The big Columbia River king salmon were called June hogs because they were fish that regularly averaged 80 pounds and consistently went over 100 pounds. And basically when they took a scale sample and said this was a six-year-old ocean fish, and they looked back and said, okay, the Bonneville Dam was being they broke ground at this point in time. The Donneville did not have a fish pass on it, so they literally killed off that mega stock of fish knowingly. Mm-hmm. This is a whole other story, but they just said, wow, this was one of the last fish. But what was interesting about it is, as I've done my research over the years, I've never found a picture of one of those large June hogs in the Columbia that was shorter than 58 inches long. I've seen like 25 pictures of pre-1900 fish, and they're this amazing fish, bigger than the biggest king salmon caught on record in the Kenai, okay? But there was something unique about that fish. It was 52 inches long. It wasn't 58 inches long. It was 1 inch shorter than that king salmon right there caught on the Kenai, which was 82 pounds, I believe. The thing looked like a tuna fish. And in Wrangell, when you ask the fishermen, what's the only king salmon that looks like a tuna being caught, they say the Bradfield River. It's immediate because there's only one fish that looks like that in southern southeast Alaska. And I looked at that fish and I compared it to the June hogs. There is no picture of a June hog that has that ratio. And it is indicative of the Bradfield Kings. Well, the Bradfield was basically harvested down to the watershed in the 60s and 70s. They actually pulled gravel out of the river to make the logging roads. They don't do that anymore. It was never rehabilitated. And the fishermen today still in Wrangell say, what would it be like if we had that robust, biggest king, potentially the biggest king salmon in the world, you know, in southeast Alaska is where it came from. It didn't come from the Columbia. And there have been retired Forest Service people, fishing and game people, that have gone on record to write to say, why is this simply off the record? You know, why don't we bring that back? So from an economic standpoint, what would it look like to have not one Kenai River that creates enormous amounts of income for people coming to our state to catch fish, but to have two? And we currently don't have a clear, consistent process for restoring a stock of fish that has been documented to be down for the last 45 years. It has not come back. And this bill simply gives us a tool to vet through the entire fish and game process, all the different departments to look at it, and to say, you've done your homework, it hasn't come back, yes, let's bring it back. So I'm sorry I took too much time, but I think it's an important point, so thank you.
Yeah, follow-up, Representative.
Just follow, I just want to thank you for that. It's great history. It's a great story and a great message. And I very much appreciate hearing, having lived in Fairbanks for 25 years, I very, very much appreciate to know that Tanau Chiefs and their leadership are supportive of this. I think they're on the right track, and they're certainly interested in the betterment of the fishery.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So, for the rehabilitation of that stock, it would be the provision on page 1, line 10, may issue a fisheries rehabilitation permit that allows a qualified person to enhance habitat in water of the state to aid the survival of fish. Would that be?
Yeah, and the ability to restore habitat is already in place. I mean, people are restoring habitat. There's actually four tribes on Prince of Wales that are asking me to work with them because they spent the last 10 years just restoring logging rivers that have been wiped out from logging back there at the same time. But they know that the fish are simply not going to rehabilitate because the numbers are simply too depressed. And so just like Chickaloon did when they basically rehabilitated Moose Creek outside of Palmer, the Navy came in and basically made the watershed a chute to send coal down so the Navy ships could collect it because it was a high grade of coal. They spent several hundred thousand dollars, I think it was $1 million, over 3 years basically putting the watershed back. But once they did, they just simply said, it could be generations before we ever see a fish stray in here because, as you guys know in South Central, the only time you see a fish stray is if there's so many fish in a creek that a fish goes, there's no room for me. I want to spawn here. There's no room. I'm going to go look elsewhere. But we don't have stocks of fish like that are that robust to push that strain anymore. And that's the reason why the fish don't come back in this case. So Yes. You basically have mechanisms to do rehabilitation. It would necessarily be a Superfund project, and I plan on talking to our leadership in Washington to say, we're not pointing fingers that you guys did this wrong because there's learning curves and things happen the way they happen. Mm-hmm. But we need some help because it's going to be a huge project to restore that world-class watershed so that that genetically discrete stock that may or may not still be there, we don't even know that, mm-hmm. to basically bring that back. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. But to do that, if, follow up, mm-hmm. in the unfortunate event that you're not able to find members of that stock, this bill, it seems, would allow you to restore all the habitat, but not to reestablish a run.
That is correct. And again, this bill is not necessary to restore habitat. That's already in place.
Okay.
This bill's primarily focused to say, and I think that's intended to address the fact that if you have a habitat issue, you definitely have to address that, too, because the fish have to have a house to live in. And when I have communities come to me and say, we need help restoring this stock, it's been gone, I say, how's the house? Does the habitat need to be rehabilitated first, which was the case with the Moose Creek watershed in Chickalone. They had to fix the fish's house first and then reintroduce the fish.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A couple questions, Mr. Ashton. I appreciate this is really helpful info. In the lower 48, where they're doing a lot of the dam removal, and it's the same kind of thing as this Moose River project you're talking about, do you know if, because they're, I know their concern is the same thing, that if we just let the wild stock, come back to that area and rebuild and become strong, it could take, decades and decades before that could happen. So the discussion of supplementing those stocks is a part of that, overall effort. And sort of two pieces to this. So in those efforts, do you know if they're using, to the extent possible, stock that was native to that or indigenous to that river? And then the second part of this is one of the concerns I've heard raised is with hatchery fish, there's a real specific effort made to release the fish in places other than where the indigenous stock would be. But what makes this different is, that these would be released back to the same river. And just if you can see sort of where I'm going with that, if you know anything about what they're doing in the lower 48, which of those options they're picking. And then, if you could just sort of compare and contrast those two from your perspective about why it would be okay that this is doing, different from what the hatcheries do. And why that works in this circumstance.
Sure, and I'll try to be brief. So in the lower 48, they did a big push to put in fish culverts that could pass fish because they realized when they put in these certain culverts that it was basically making a waterfall at the end and it blocked off fish from being able to use the habitat. When they started putting in these flat bottom culverts, after they realized the error of their ways, really in some cases decades later, they fixed them, but they went, if you build it, they will come. It's not working here because there's no stock there big enough to stray now. And so in examples like that, they're using that. But then the question is they bring in like state and federal managers, stakeholders in the area, and they have these meetings to say, the indigenous species is gone. What do you guys want to do? And a lot of times they'll look at the genetics and things like that, and they'll say, 5 miles away, there's this stock here. And then clearly that stock was related to this region because it's also here, here, and here. So because it's in more than one spot, it would be prudent for us to use that stock. Everybody agrees, and they say, okay, we're going to borrow that stock because technically it's covering the region here, so we're going to use that. I was involved in the development of the Oneida Bay cost recovery just outside of Wrangell, which was actually a place to say, okay, we need to have a terminal harvest area for the commercial fishing for the hatchery. And the criteria for that getting approved, which took years, and I was out there in a punt in the middle of wintertime collecting data and doing bathymetric surveys of the place and looking at all these things to make sure that site would be an acceptable site. And one of the big deals for Fish and Game is they look at how that interaction is going to be with any indigenous stocks around the area. And their data suggests that there were no significant stocks in that area, so they were able to say, looking at how it interacts with the wild stocks, we're comfortable that that's not going to be a problem, so you can proceed. And does that answer your question?
Well, and a little bit, I guess, just that one of the concerns that's been raised about this bill is you know, the fact that instead of, you know, I mean, I guess the intent, though, is you're rehabilitating a particular stock of concern, so that's why you're going to, you know, use eggs from that stock and then, you know, release back into that same area. So in that sense,
yeah,
you know, keeping similarly.
The intent was to take everything that we've learned so far about genetics and write a very conservative process that takes everything we know to make sure that we're super conservative in what we do. You basically say this stock, this fish is not meeting escapement, so we're going to go in and grab fish from that stock, help them survive, and then put them right back and walk away. No pens, no feeding, no nothing. And so it's radically different than a lot of the accepted methods and processes that these mega hatcheries use right now. And although there's a lot of concern by certain people about the hatchery operations that are in existence today, what I basically say to people, I say, not only is this absolutely a completely different process, but don't be so quick to basically throw the hatcheries under the bus, because I was around when the stocks crashed in the 70s. I was pretty young. I was living in Hoonah, but I saw those fishermen struggling. And these hatcheries basically have stabilized the income opportunities in our commercial fisheries and have helped dramatically. But do we need to constantly look at how we're going to tweak that and make it better? That's the key. And I feel confident that we have enough people involved in these discussions to constantly look at how we operate hatcheries. And as we continue to learn more, we make course corrections.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just following up on some of that, one of the critics, for lack of a better word, is concerned that if the hatchery occurs and the maturity or the, I suppose, the taking ultimately occurs in the same location as the original wild stock, that there'd be no way to measure how much of the wild stock you're taking because they're commingled. Does that make some sense, and is that a concern?
It does, and part of the process that was written out in this bill was to make sure that you actually have a very thorough pre-plan that justifies what you're doing. And I have a white paper that I can provide to you that I give to anybody that says, we have a stock of concern, we need to do something about it, where do we start? I give them a sheet of paper that half of the people just basically fall off the radar because they go, whoa, this is serious science. We don't have the resources, the capability to follow through with this. Unless we can find some partners to help us, we can't do this, because you have to define the need to make sure that you're doing it right. And the genetics that you're speaking to are a big part of that, making sure that you are managing this appropriately so that the genetics department can say, yes, we've checked that off. You've looked at you're talking about discrete subpopulations within a bigger watershed. And one of the things that genetics is finding more and more in, like in the case of the Yukon River, that's, you know, over 1,000 miles long, there's a lot of populations of king salmon, of coho and chum all the way up the river. And so when you go in and find one watershed that's basically at risk, you need to do the due diligence to make sure you have the numbers, so when you put the permit in, you can say, historically we used to have this many fish going up the river. Now we have this many. This is our plan. And you have to vet through all these different issues, including genetics, to basically pass muster to get a permit to say, okay, you've done due diligence. If someone comes in and just basically says, you know, this river system looks like you could have salmon in it, it doesn't, we just want to go plant some eggs in it, I can attest to you, because I first personally have said, I can't help you. And what I'm able to do is I give them that white sheet to say, okay, this is your checklist you have to do. I don't have to tell them no. I just educate them to the thorough level of science and preparation you have to do. And, of course, if they then go to Fish and Game and say, okay, well, he's not going to help us because he's going to make us do all this work, then they go to Fish and Game, and Fish and Game goes, these are all the things you have to do to prepare to make sure this is a valid thing to do. Does that answer your question, sir?
Partially, yeah.
Okay.
Let me follow up. I assume that the hatchery raised, and I know that this is not a conventional hatchery, it's a sort of new model, But these salmon are not landlocked. They're not like lake salmon. And so whatever may be causing a problem downstream, I mean, people talk about false pass and that sort of thing, why wouldn't that problem just continue? Is the idea to sort of just grow the number to such an extent that it defeats the problem?
That's a very good question. Through the chair, is that what I'm supposed to say? Okay. I haven't been doing that, so I apologize. Through the chair. That's a very good question. there are going to be interception issues that might have caused the problem in the first place. But what this basically does is, for whatever reason, you have a stock that's diminished. This is simply going to take the eggs that have successfully gone through the gamut of juvenile stages in the ocean, and they've made it back, and simply have more of those wild eggs that came back to the river simply survive. And so it's a multifaceted issue to make sure the false pass interception is managed. You have, maybe there's international trawlers out there that you've got to work on that international agreement, things like this. What this simply does is it basically just augments the survival of those that simply made it back. So you take one risk out of it that we can basically do, and do it very conservatively, and simply help them survive until we get those bigger issues taken care of. I'll give an example, though. You talk to the elders around Wrangell, and there's a lot of small watersheds on the back channel behind Wrangell that simply have no measurable amount of salmon anymore. I went back to some documents from the earliest documents on Western occupation in that area, because the English actually came in addition to the Russians. And one federal report from like 1864 documented where all the tribal houses were along the back channel. There were 9. Now, it's accepted to say that they would not have been there if there wasn't a resource that would have had them be there. And management of the fisheries was a big deal. I've had elders when I was in Hunit talk about how they would go in and prepare the creeks to make sure the fish could make it back to the creeks. Mm-hmm. They actually did escapement management. And if they didn't have the fish returned to the numbers they needed, this is where I got the idea from, because the elders simply said, we took the eggs from the males and the sperm from the eggs from the females and the sperm from the males. We fertilized them and put them in cedar baskets back in the creek. Escapement met. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was, you could have a senior come in without knowing it, do a great round haul and do a great haul of fish, and literally wipe out a very, very small, discrete subpopulation of fish in a very small river system, and you'd never know what happened. Mm-hmm. And where you have all those longhouses that are documented, there's simply no major fisheries back there anymore. So they're gone. They didn't come back. And so my point is that the genetics of what you're talking about, you go into a river system and you say, we're going to take fish from this local area. You have to basically have a plan to say, and by the way, we know that there's a subpopulation here and a subpopulation here and here. And you have to basically explain your understanding of that and how you're going to manage for that, to make sure that you address all those issues in order to do this permit.
Any follow-up?
Yeah, just a follow-up. Another concern that's been expressed is about the qualifications required for this model, and concern that, for example, anyone who receives a PFD could theoretically apply. How do you understand this? What is your response to that concern, I guess?
My response is that you're not going to fill out a permit that would be considered by Alaska Department of Fish and Game if you didn't know what you're doing. And no matter how you learned to do it, unless you know what you're doing, you're not going to get a permit that flies. I mean, these people are not going to sit around the campfire and come up with a harebrained idea to put fish into a creek where they're not there, and Fish and Game is going to give them the time of day to pass that permit, because understanding how to do this is very serious when it comes to our wild stocks and making sure they're healthy. And so to me, either you demonstrate that you know how to do this and you're qualified, and that's going to be reflected in your statement of qualifications with your permit, or you're not going to get the permit. So it's this has been a process that's been going on for decades. Fish and Game is pretty good about saying no. Especially if they're going, you know what, we don't know. So until we know, no. Which is a good position to take with our wild salmon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
We had Representative Rauscher and then Representative Johnson. And then I think we have one other individual signed up to testify, and we'll do that, and then we might set this aside because we're going to bring it back up, and that way we can get to the second item that Terra Nova has been so patiently waiting for. Representative Rauscher.
I believe my question was answered during the representative's question, so I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if I could I don't know what all your background and qualifications, but you sound like very knowledgeable, and I guess I just have a couple questions I'm curious about. and I was maybe you could answer. So in this process, so say you have the eggs, fertilize the eggs, at what point do they have to be in the stream to basically align their magnetic compass or whatever they do to get back to the stream that they were there? At what point do fish do that? I mean, I guess it's fry. It's not egg.
If you give me your email address, I'll send you a paper that was just completed in Washington 1 year ago that actually was able to realize what you're referring to as imprinting. And they just realized, they just had a paper come out. It was very interesting where in the development of those juveniles from the time that the egg gets fertilized, which actually has some water from the river go into it during that process, to the time when it hatches and actually is an elephin where it's basically has a yolk sac and it's in the gravel, and it stays there until it uses up the yolk sac, gets hungry, comes out of the gravel as emergent fry. This study talks about all three of those stages basically have processes where it basically imprints not only to the river, but to the poor place in the river that it came from. And each species is different about that, too. There's some species that basically are pretty, for lack of a better term, loose about where they go spawn in the river. There's species like sockeye that are very specific about going, I'm going here in the river, you know. And so there are several stages in development where they basically become imprinted from the water, from the minerals in the water, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm obviously fish by. Well, I know how to fish, but I don't know a lot about fish. So, but I did have I think I was speaking at or introducing some people at a fish conference a few years ago, and one of the presentations spoke to not only did the fish imprint on the river. It actually, they found now that they imprint on a place out in the ocean. So the fish from a specific stream will actually go to a certain coordinate in the ocean every year. And so some of those, so this is, you know, so I don't know at what point that imprinting happens. So I was trying to put all this together in my mind with the, you know, however this type of hatching would happen, but I mean, it always left the question open to me: is if you have one coordinate, say in the ocean, where fish are returning to, you know, each stream goes to this one place, wherever it is out in the ocean, which is, you know, we talk a lot about the fish we see in the streams because we see them in the streams and we know they return, but we haven't really actually seen them go out and go to a certain spot in the ocean. But that, you know, And I, you know, more research that I would need to know. I don't know for sure, but if some of these places in Alaska, I this is where I wanted to ask you the question is, you know, if they're fishing, one spot in the ocean is getting fished heavily, that may be that our certain fish, certain streams, I mean, they no matter what you do, you know, they're not going to get that return in the same way, or if you had heard or knew anything about some of that.
You just went above my pay grade in understanding. The ocean survival is a very complex process that they're still using new and new technologies for radio telemetry and stuff to see where fish are migrating to. They've identified areas where they go and stuff. I haven't done a lot of research on that, but our fish and game representative would have a lot more information specifically to that. What I can say is that there are generally in regions of the Northwest, they know these fish have been found to be over in this area. And then over here in this area and stuff like that, but I don't have a lot of detail on that.
Fellow, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was kind of emerging research at the time that I heard it a few years ago, and I don't, you know, from the part of the presentation that I listened to, it certainly sounded like there was a lot there that would continue to add to the mystery of the, you know, missing fish. And so, anyway, I was just curious.
If I may make one closing remark quickly through the chair, the need for us to collect more and more data is really important to understand our resources, both in the river systems and the estuaries, but also in the ocean. And a big part of the reason why I've really focused on not just simply having these processes for agencies to do, but to really dovetail us into stakeholders, is we desperately need applied science curriculums in our schools. And when we've gone into certain schools and actually allowed these kids to touch fish and to do some scientific data and stuff, but they get to really touch a fish and not just look at it on a video or hold a piece of paper, but they get to go in the creek for science, man, attention just goes through the roof. And so it's almost weird because they say, yes, we need this policy, we need this tool. And we need this tool to allow us to do applied science curriculum in our schools because we need to raise up the next generation of managers for Alaska. We just simply need to do that. And this dovetails right into that whole process. It's not simply about the fish. It's about how we approach management of our natural resources so we don't lose them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ashton. Really appreciate your information and like the time you could spend with us. We're going to go to our last public testifier this afternoon, Sarah Obed from Fairbanks.
Hi, thank you. This is Sarah. Can you hear me?
Yep, okay. We can hear you.
Thank you to the chair and to all of the committee members. I will just briefly state Doyon's support for HB 107. We've mostly been supporting the efforts from Tanana Chiefs Conference to support this bill, and we did submit a letter for the record indicating our support for HB 107. We understand that the bill would allow individuals and Alaska corporations, school districts, and other organizations to apply for fish enhancement permits through ADFNG, and it would allow to collect this limited amount of fish and fertilize and hatch the eggs and place the natural fish back into the water where they were taken, with the expectation that will boost the fertility rate of the eggs. So therefore, we support the bill on behalf of our board and Doyon Unlimited Management and our shareholders from the interior. We support HB 107.
Thank you, Ms. Obed. We really appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay, well, again, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. What we're going to do, we've talked with the bill sponsor, and so appreciate his willingness to work with us. As you can tell from the conversation, there have been some concerns raised, primarily, I think, around the genetic diversity issue, and so got a lot of those questions answered. But because we're a little pressed on time right now, what we'll do is set this bill aside. We'll give members an opportunity to work with the sponsor and prepare any amendments, if there's an interest in offering any amendments. And then we will email, possibly bring this back before committee on Friday. And so we'll keep everybody in the loop on that. But if you do want to offer amendments, if you could start working on those, that way we'll keep sort of moving things along. Okay? Okay, so then up next, thank you for your patience, is House Bill 197, pardon me, on community seed libraries. And before we get started, I know we're going to consider a committee substitute. I want to make sure everybody has the committee substitute in front of them. I think it's going to be version O.
Yes, that's correct. Okay.
Nor I.
Okay.
Is this the set of amendments which constitutes the change to version O?
There's an additional amendment. So just want to make sure everybody has version O. We have not adopted that, but that's the one we're going to work off of, so you have it before we get started. And then there should be an amendment that is O.1 that everybody should have a copy of. So those are going to be the two documents we'll be looking on to here momentarily.
Okay.
Okay. So, yes. So, to get us started, Mr. Co-Chair would entertain a motion for the work draft.
Yes. I move that the House Resources Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 197, work draft version 30-LS0493/O.
Okay. And I'll object for purposes of discussion. If you could please let us know what the changes are.
Yes, this is Taryn Novotasker, representative for our staff for Representative Jennifer Johnston. After talking with the community and our hearing last time, we took up a few suggestions, and so this new version addresses some of the issues. So it amends Section 4 and allows for a personal non-commercial transfer of seeds. So this was the issue where, you know, someone's grandmother could give seeds to her neighbors, and that wouldn't be in violation of any code or regulation, but that would exist outside of the seed library. And then the next change would allow for seeds from a plant that's grown outside of Alaska to be used in a seed library as long as they complied with, you know, interstate transport of, you know, commercial seeds.
If you could just mention that, where the changes are. So that next change looks like it's page 4, line 7?
Yes, page 4, line 7. Right, let me pull that up so I'm on the same page here. And then, so the next change would occur also on page 4, line 15, and so that increases the value or the volume of seed sharing to 1 pound, and that was an issue. A few people had brought up that the previous limit was perhaps not enough seeds for some of our larger weighty seeds. And then also on page 4, kind of lines 27 through 30, we added a section that would not allow anyone to use marijuana seeds as it pertains to seed libraries. Just that's not the intent of the bill. So those are the changes that were made in version O. If anyone has any questions.
Thank you. We appreciate that introduction. Any questions for the bill sponsor or her staff? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Taryn Nova, first of all, I don't know much about seeds, so I'm certain no one's ever called me a seed expert. But what I'm curious about is you've heard of one. It's a form of criticism from someone named P.S. Holloway. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I believe so. But if you want to refresh,
well, essentially what they're asking is why the bill is necessary when it's a deregulated process now. And secondarily, and sort of connected to that, is why they're the current system. I mean, it's sort of an entirely unregulated system. Is free, and why that sort of system isn't working. And I'm just sort of airing those.
Yes, through the chair, I can answer that in part. And then I just want to double check to see if Rob Carter is on the line. So I'll start, and then he's been great at filling in some information. So it's essentially this bill comes about because in the way that the statute is currently written, any seed in the state must be regulated. Based on the way it's written. And then you must go to the code to find the 2 pages of regulation. That's germination percentages, weights, everything you would need for kind of a commercial operation. So this bill, while it seems to be not regulated, it is, based on the interpretation of the department. And so this is carving out a section specifically so that seed libraries can exist and then they can have control over what goes on in their seed library, aside from some basic labeling. But I will also defer it over to Rob Carter because he's great at explaining as well.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Mr. Carter, are you available?
Madam Chair, yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear the question from Representative Josephson? A commenter said this is, you know, an unregulated activity at this time, so why would a bill be necessary, if I'm characterizing that correctly?
Yes, Madam Chair, I did hear the question. For the record, this is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag, manager of the Alaska Plant Material Center. To the Chair, Representative Josephson, you know, that's the unfortunate misnomer for individuals that are not familiar with the current seed regulations in 11AAC Chapter 34. Currently, within multiple sections of that, any section or any seed that is transported around the state of Alaska for use in planting, no matter the quantity, a ton or a gram, it does have to meet our labeling requirements, which are pretty rigorous germination, purity, and invasive weed testing, which would really defeat the purpose of non-commercial seed sharing because these individuals have no intent to sell or generate revenue. They do it for rural food security. They do it for genetic diversity. And then in turn, to say that it's a non-regulated thing, it is. It's just not in the best reason or the Department of Natural Resources Division of Agriculture to go out there and start slapping stop orders on a bunch of Alaskans that are just trying to provide closer, better, fresher food and keep genetic diversity among seeds within the state of Alaska.
A follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Carter. So what I hear you saying is that this is more regulated than people believe pursuant to Title 11 of the Alaska Administrative Code. Is that and so this sort of this legislation springs out of that regulation, in a sense?
That's for the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. People just don't understand that both the Federal Seed Act as well as the accessory code that regulates seed here in the state of Alaska, this activity is actually already against those. As I said, it's just not in the best interest. Let's say, or for say, we have bigger fish to fry. Seed laws are passed with good intention. They've been around for a long time. It's just in recent years, many other states have started applying these laws to non-commercial seed sharing and seed libraries that are more fit for consumer protection, protection of the farming community, the agricultural industry, and applying those laws without reason.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Johnson?
Yes, I do. I have a question for Rob. Good to hear from someone from Palmer. I was just wondering on, we all are familiar with the term community seed libraries, and it's kind of became a known title, but is there any difference between a community seed library and just a seed library? I mean, does that have any kind of special meaning?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. Oh, sorry. For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. No, that's there's no difference between any of them. Some people consider them a multitude of different common names, and in the seed regulatory side and agricultural industry, we all look at them as non-commercial seed sharing activities that are normally located within a library, a nonprofit, or a community organization, or a community event, or just a private agency that has space to allow one.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one is also for Mr. Carter. On page 3, line 24, it sets up a contrast between seeds and, well, rather, plants grown outside the state and in the state. Outside the state, it says, and imported into the state in compliance with AS 0305010A5, or in the state and untreated with a substance toxic to humans, animals, or pollinating insects. My question to you would be, does the statute I referenced above allow seeds, or rather plants, which were treated with substances toxic to humans, animals, or pollinating insects?
For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I believe that it does. I believe that that reference, you have to remember that plants and seeds are very different critters when it comes to the regulatory process, so we'll speak to only seeds in this. It does. Any seed currently now that's being made available for sale or offered for sale has to have that specifically on its label within the package. And so in this case, it is not allowing that within community seed libraries, which I believe from a professional standpoint of dealing with
massive quantities of seed that had been treated prior to plant or sale, that those labeling requirements be met. And I think this is doing the due diligence so that an individual in a free non-commercial seed library may have children there. Sometimes these seed coatings that that have been treated with a pesticide are in bright colors, and just to remove that by chance that an individual may get sick or very sick and die from ingestion of those, it's in the best interest of non-commercial use to just not allow that within the seed libraries.
Is there a follow-up?
I suppose I probably ought to follow up. I quite agree that in a seed library, one shouldn't have any seeds which have been treated with toxic substances. I guess I have trouble seeing why we should allow seeds treated with toxic substances in community seed libraries if they're coming from out of state. Perhaps you could provide some clarity on that.
The seed.
For the record, this is Rob Carter. I'm sitting here looking at that section right now, sir. And to me, it's looking that it says both within line 24 on page 3, outside the state and imported into the state in compliance with 0305010, or in the state and untreated with any substance. I think if you are uncomfortable with saying that you think that there may be a loophole there for out-of-state seed to be treated and shared within those, I'm sure the bill sponsor would be more than happy to have the addition of that language. I think it could be interpreted either way, and that's a very good catch.
Thank you.
If I may, I must say, Representative Parrish, it's not every day that a member of a committee says, "That's a very good catch, so I commend you for it."
Thank you.
Or here's that, rather.
Well, and I think, Mr. Carter, this is Representative Tarr. It would be difficult if the plant is, you know, being brought into the state to be able to sort of certify in some way what happened prior to it coming to Alaska.
For the record, this is Rob Carter. Madam Chair, you are correct. It would be very difficult to regulate all imported plants, and currently we do not do that at the Division of Ag. In any case, majority of plants that have been treated with a systemic pesticide for a multitude of different reasons, you know, a lot of those chemicals don't carry forth within the progeny of those seed. So I don't think that that is a necessary step within this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Parrish, did you have any other comments or questions about that?
Thank you, yes. It seems like if we have the provision that seeds from outside the state should be similarly untreated, or and to avoid having to regulate every other state, we could go with some nationwide standard like organic, for all the things that that means and doesn't mean.
Mr. Carter, I don't know if you have any comments on that. I will say what would be a challenge is, you know, you could probably find vegetable starts that are imported that are organic, but I, as an organic gardener myself, can tell you it, if someone was wanting to do this with flowers or other sort of showy plants, I think that'd be very difficult because I don't think, I can't think of any opportunity to purchase certified organic, you know, just kind of garden landscaping plants. But Mr. Carter, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, I agree with you 100%. I will say that in that addition that you have to be very careful. The USDA organic standard is a USDA program. And putting that type of language within legislation, it can be very limiting. I think that it's up to the individual seedsman or seedswoman to do their due diligence to provide the seed that's best for the community. But that organic label that's there is something to be very wise about.
Anything else, Representative Parrish?
Not on this paragraph, no.
Okay. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor, her staff, or Mr. Carter? And just keeping in mind that what we're doing right now is we haven't adopted the version O as the work draft. We had objected for purposes of discussion. So if there's no other discussion on that, then I will remove my objection to adoption of version O, and that will be the version that is before us. We do have a couple of individuals signed up here. I think we had opened and closed public testimony last week, but I think it would be fine, since we have a few minutes, if we wanted to reopen it. There's someone from Esther and someone from Homer, and we could do that, and then I think we do have an amendment for consideration. So why don't I go ahead and reopen public testimony. We'll go to Deidre. Apologies for saying this wrong, but Helfrich, perhaps, from Esther. Deidre, if you're available.
Deidre Helfrich.
Okay, thank you. Please provide us with your name, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
Okay, my name is Deidre Helfrich. I'm from Esther. Thank you very much. I would say that there is a need for this bill simply to establish the legality of community seed libraries. I'd like to point out that there is a difference between a seed library and a seed bank. The Svalbard Seed Vault, for example, in Norway, holds germplasm for particular individuals or companies, and they're required to share the first generation with their with other researchers. But other than that, they're holding it the way they would a museum in deep freeze, or a living museum, sort of. But a community seed library or a seed library is trying to establish living plants that are adapted to the area, and to increase biodiversity, educate the community, and help fellow gardeners. So I wanted to clarify that. I do have concerns with version O, basically because of section, let's say it was page, on page 3, section C, under section 0320120, in 3, line 30 and 31, it's requiring that seed given or offered for giving has to be packaged for sale and labeled with the next 6 lines worth of requirements. This, I think, would put an undue burden on seed libraries, and although I am speaking for myself, I was the founder of the Farthest North Seed Library here in Esther, and this would add another a whole other volunteer event that you'd have to have, the seed library would have to throw on. And also it's referring again to sellers and packaging for sale, even though it's contradicted by number 5, they're not authorized for commercial use and not classified, etc. So there's an inherent contradiction in this. This is part of this is looks like it's created for sellers, and part of it is looking like it's created for people giving it, organizations giving it. So I think that's an inherent contradiction in this. And then also, making organizations essentially responsible for keeping track of how much a person receives in a year, or just receives, is I think problematic. You've got on line 2 here the seller's name and address. That's if you're having people requiring that their names and their addresses, their personal information, be added in there, you're going to have a lot fewer people participating in these organizations. So that's essentially my concerns. as to my professional experience, I worked for 14 years as the science editor at the UAF School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences. I have, as I said, sent some written testimony to the chair, to the co-chairs, and to the legislation sponsors. And again, I do want to thank you for bringing this up because I do think it's necessary. Dr. Holloway may think we were not actually, we were doing just fine, but we were sort of skating under the radar. And as Rob Carter said, it just wasn't worth, we're small fry.
Okay, well, we really appreciate your testimony this afternoon. I hope you can stay online because there is an amendment that I hope we'll have time for that addresses in part your concern about seller's name and address. And so I'll just hold that thought, and I hope you can stay with us. And then the weight, the tracking of the weight in the committee substitute has been raised to 1 pound. I don't know if that changes your reaction to that, but just, or if it's the idea that you have to sort of track a cumulative amount and that would become challenging and the personal information. So we have definitely taken note of those items.
It, to answer your implied question, Madam Chairwoman, it was the idea of having to track.
Okay.
That was my concern.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate you that you had sent emails earlier and then also that you could join us this afternoon. We will go next to Jan Flora in Homer, and then I am going to try and keep us on track here so we can get to the amendment before we run out of time.
Hi, this is Jan Flora. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
I appreciate this bill a lot. You know, we have big food security concerns in Alaska, and this will help us build community resilience. We had no idea that us seed savers and seed swappers were outlaws until I read the bill. So I appreciate it. Version O looks great. Homer, Alaska has over 200 high tunnels. It's the most in any zip code in the United States. And small ag is booming around here. And this will help us. We want to build a seed library in Homer. This will help us help our community grow more food for our families. So that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flora. We really appreciate your testimony this afternoon. Wondering if anybody has any questions for her. Pardon me, I got dropped a note right as I was saying something. I got distracted there. Any questions for Ms. Flora? Representative Johnson and then Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, hi there. This is Delana Johnson. I just wanted to say it's good to hear from you, and thank you for calling in, and appreciate hearing from you.
Yeah, thank you.
And Representative Parrish.
Wow. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be a follow-up on the last caller's statement that the packaging requirements set out in the bill would be a burden to people wanting to engage in seed libraries, and I just wanted to have your thoughts on that.
I agree with the last caller that I really don't want to put my name and address on seeds. I concur with what she said on that.
Thank you.
I don't know. You know, you just swap seeds with your friends, and they know where they got them. And for the purposes of a community seed library, you know, maybe somebody can keep a binder and have a code number on packages. Somebody knows where that seed came from because you've got a code on the package. Mm-hmm. So you've got some trace back capability.
Thank you very much.
I don't think I answered your question, did I?
No, I think you did a swell job. And I really do appreciate the suggestion.
Yeah. Oh, in the bill, it says that Division of Ag or DNR should publish where the seed libraries are. They already published the Alaska Grown Directory that's got all the farmers and stock growers and everybody in it that wants to be in it. It's voluntary. But that'd be a terrific place to publish seed library information. You know, another half page and you've got it. Boom.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Flora. That's another good suggestion. And I think Rob Carter had said before that they thought it wouldn't be a problem, and perhaps that's one of the ideas as well as on their website. Noticing the time right now, what I'm going to do is go ahead and close public testimony here again. And now we have version O back before us. I'm going to go ahead and move amendment number one, which is 30-LS0493/O.1. Do you want to object?
I will object for purposes of discussion.
Okay. And so I'll just walk through. What this one does is in part address the issue of the information that's required. So on page 3, line 31, it would delete the words for sale. So it would just read that it's labeled and packaged. So that kind of removes the must be packaged and labeled, pardon me, so that removes some of the confusion about sort of the sale element of it. On page 4, line 2, you delete seller's name and address and instead insert name and address of the person giving or offering the seed. Page 4, line 3, again, delete for sale. Page 4, lines 7 through 9, delete all material. So that it gets at some of the issue about the where it's grown. Page 4, lines 12 through 14, delete that is harvested from a plant grown outside the state unless the seed is in the original packaging. So just delete that. Page 4, lines 22 and 23, it's just changing the statutory reference, and that's probably from renumbering. And then page 5, lines 3 and 4, deleting that material.
Doesn't say that. Oh, sorry, I didn't see.
On the back side. So any questions or comments about this amendment? And we do still have Rob Carter on the line. Representative Johnson.
My question. Oh, so page 23, I'm sorry, page 5, line 3 and 4, is that deleted?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I have a question, Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Josephson.
The definition of exchange, we don't need that because why?
And maybe Mr. Carter or Terra Nova, if you wanted to address that.
Yes, through the chair. So we went back and forth a little bit. Once, you know, we've cleaned up the language, so the buy or sell part is removed from the whole bill. Exchange, I don't, when I talked to legal, exchange didn't really need to be defined in that context because we've taken out the gray area. That's my understanding. I don't know if Rob wants to jump in, but I think that was our reasoning.
Thank you.
Mr. Carter, do you have anything you would like to add to that?
No, Madam Chair. I am on track with Tara Nova's comment.
Okay. And on the other point, because we do have the opportunity while in discussion for this amendment, when we could consider, for example, a conceptual amendment, on the idea of name and address of the person giving or offering the seed, is your interpretation that could be something that was, you know, held in a binder, so if, you know, people wanted to follow up or get that contact information, it would be available, but that it doesn't need to be physically on the package for the people who are sort of raising concerns about wanting to give their personal information?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. I think that removal of that language actually simplifies that process. I actually believe that a simple sign above the seed library itself, which most seed Rolodexes, I guess, per se, within these seed libraries already have a name. We'll use Esther as an example. I'm sure that they have one there. I think that the individual interpreting this language from a seed regulatory aspect, as long as there was a sign and the name and the address of the seed library itself above the seed sharing activities within that facility, it would meet the requirements of this legislation.
Okay. Representative Parrish has a question.
So am I to understand that from the point of view of the department, it would be sufficient to have the name and address of the seed library rather than the provider of the original seed?
I think the chair representative Parrish, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. So that clears that up, that as far as name and address specific to the seed library, not specific to the individual person, so you're not giving out your name and address and some of them in the middle of the night come take your prize carrots. Representative Rauscher.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair, if the address of the seller is on the packet, who's responsible here?
Maybe we could ask Mr. Carter, but what it sounded like is that the name and address could be, you know, the seed library and location rather than, you know, guarantor who donated these seeds to the, you know, Anchorage Community Seed Library. It would be...
I'm just
Anchorage
following the last comment library. That it was okay, yeah, for the library is the name and address, not the
individual
producer. Mm-hmm. Who's responsible, and who do they contact in case of a problem?
Do you want to take that or ask Mr. Carter?
I'll take a stab through the chair. Based on my understanding, I think in the purpose of creating the community seed library, that does give the department a place to go in case there is an issue and allows some path for tracking if need be. I think, you know, if you think of Esther, you know, it's a tight-knit community. I think regardless of whether someone put their name and address down, I think community members would likely know who's giving what seeds in smaller areas. But that is a good point, and I will defer to Rob to fill in anything I might have missed.
Mr. Carter?
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Rob Carter, through the chair, Representative Rauscher. I think trying to say who is liable is a difficult question for me to ask. I'm not sure what their liability would be, but if there was an infringement on some other issue where an invasive weed or a marijuana seed was being exchanged or another item that this legislation made unapplicable, it would be the responsibility of the seed library to stop that activity.
Any follow-up?
So he did.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
No follow-up?
No, I'm good.
Okay. any other discussion on amendment number one? Representative Wesley.
No, I do, through the chair. I think what we're doing here is it's botanists. It's people that just want to exchange seeds. I mean, I think if I exchange 12 seeds with Representative Tallarico, it's not the 12 seeds of destruction from Matsu Mary. I think if we can keep it less onerous and just get these things out and do what they love to do, I think is if I understand the author's intention. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Westlake. Representative Johnson, and still under consideration of amendment number one.
Well, I thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you for all the hard work that this the person that brought forward the bill has done, and I think taken into consideration a number of opinions and a number of different rewrites and amendments, and I put a lot into it. I mean, I said it before, you know. Well, pretty sure people are going to continue to share seeds. I know that from a state perspective, I know they have to do their due diligence when it comes to invasive species and so on. But, you know, so my motto here is, you know, when seed sharing is outlawed, only outlaws will share seeds. So I think that's what Dean was trying to trying to say, and they're just trying to kind of do the right thing, and I think this helps get there. So.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number one. Wait. You have a comment on the amendment.
Would this be an appropriate time, Madam Chair, to offer a friendly amendment to change line 6 of the amendment to read, insert name of seed library giving or offering the seed?
And I will just object for purposes of discussion. We were just looking at that, and if we look on page 3, section 03.20.120 is the Community Seed Library section. And so I think that's why the, you know, the language, because it's in that Community Seed Library section, is like that. So it says the name and address of the person giving or offering the seed, but it's supposed to mean the Community Seed Library because it's in that section. However, if it adds more clarity, then your conceptual amendment, Representative Drummond, was to, after name, but we may want to consider after address, but what you were suggesting was after the word name, it would say of the Community Seed Library.
If I might address my amendment,
mm-hmm.
All the objections that I heard mm-hmm. from the folks who testified was that they objected to having the giver of the seed's name and address. And the suggestion that I heard in conversation was that instead of the giver's name and address of a particular person with their private information, mm-hmm. which it isn't truly, but that's another discussion, instead replace the name and address of the person with the name of the seed library that was the source of the seed. That's a very simple amendment. In listening to all of this for the last 45 minutes, that seemed to be the largest objection from testifiers.
And Representative Drummond, what I'm saying is the way it's written right now, it actually is the Community Seed Library, but we could consider the amendment just for points of clarity. But did you want to remove the word address?
Well, Madam Chair, are we referring to the seed library as the person?
Yes.
Oh. Well, this gets back to that corporate business that we all don't like. No, I think it should say name of seed library, period. End of story. Simpler.
Name of seed library and or...
No, just name of seed library. As Mr. Carter said, mm-hmm. he'll know
mm-hmm. which one it is.
If you're talking about Esther, that there's a seed library in Esther. And as another speaker said, it would take half a page in that document that the state publishes to list the number of seed libraries. So that just simplifies this. This whole thing is just too bureaucratic for me, and I'm trying to address the concerns of the testifiers, and that's the one that I heard. Loud and clear, was they don't want their names and addresses distributed. But the name of the seed library, which should be tracking these things because it's a local thing, that ultimately if there's an issue with a seed and you need to find out who it came from, the seed library can be responsible for tracking that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnston, excuse me.
And I'm really getting in over my head here, but... I think we should maybe leave the language as is, because there are opportunities for individuals to act in an exchange where you might still want to have the individual's name and address there versus just the seed library. And since it's already established in this as is, I think we're safe with this. I won't go to the mat on this, but I think we're fine.
Representative Parrish, and then we'll lose our room here in a few short moments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to speak briefly in support of Representative Drummond's conceptual amendment to the amendment. I think that the less onerous we can make this for participants, the better. Actually, I think it would be adequate to say that a community seed library should make reasonable accommodations for participants to know X, Y, and Z, to avoid having to individually label each package.
Okay, so the conceptual amendment to amendment number 1 is on line 6 after the word name, insert of the Community Seed Library, and then you would delete and address of the person. Mm-hmm. So it would read name of the Community Seed Library giving or offering the seed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I will remove my objection to that conceptual amendment. And so that language then has it been adopted if there's no other objection. Okay.
Clerk has that.
Yes. And then that brings amendment number one back before us. Any other discussion on amendment number one? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment as it is removes a couple of restrictions on out-of-state seeds that originate out-of-state, the one that they should be in their original packaging. And, oh, shoot. And I've lost my place in the bill. But it removes a few restrictions is the main point. So I, and that makes me less comfortable with the bill as a whole, particularly if we're setting a number of other requirements on it in which the origin of the seed could be lost. And I'll reiterate my earlier concern that if we're going to be make it unclear which seeds are coming from in-state and which states or which seeds are not, it only makes it more important that we hold them to the same standards with regards to toxins as we discussed elsewhere. There's no reason why seed treated with neonicotinoids, for instance, couldn't be passed off in a community. Thank you. Neonicotinoids. Thank you. Couldn't be passed off in a community seed library with the amendment as offered.
Terranova, did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, through the chair, removing that specific language, the original packaging is something that Rob and I talked about, and he can chime in, that would actually make this process more complicated for those who are trying to share seeds. I mean, it's my understanding that if a seed goes from California to Alaska, regardless of its state, it still has to comply with the Federal Seed Act, and there still are safeguards to prevent harmful seeds from going one place to another without any control. So I don't want the impression to be that this is removing any safeguards. I think it really has to do with an access issue. But Rob can definitely speak to this as well.
Because we're going to be out of time here momentarily, what I'm going to do is I'm going to remove rescind my motion in moving amendment number one, so that we can have this amendment back before us on Friday, and we'll bring the bill back before it. However, what I would ask is for anyone on the committee to please work with the bill sponsor if you do have problems, you know, with sections of amendment that now, because people probably didn't have time to review that. Drew was going to try and take a committee photo that we've tried to take for like 3 weeks. If people have one more minute, he's waiting out in the hallway for us, just in our seats, though. He was just going to come in and do the committee photo. Dean, do you have one second? He's waiting, I'm told, in the hall for us.
Leave the papers in.
We've tried this maybe 5 or 8 times. I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the committee at 3:12, but if Drew could...